What the Health with Gabby Allen on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to What the Health. As you can see, not Gabby. My name is Harriet Harper. I'm standing in for Gabby today, otherwise known as Harriet Harper Fitness. I am an online coach. If you don't follow me on social media, Harriet_Harper_fitness. And I'm, as I said, here to cover Gabby today. And I am super, super excited because we have some amazing guests on the show that I cannot wait to speak to. As you know, what the Health, we speak through all things health and fitness. So coming up on the show today, we have Mary McCarthy, running extraordinaire and fitness content creator, Joanne Harry, journalist and author of Magic Pill. So we're going to be speaking all things Ozempic. But first on the show, we are joined by Joanna Ward. Joanna Ward of the Cosmetic Skin Clinic. I'm so excited for this conversation because I have had polynucleotides. And for those who don't know, polynucleotides are the salmon sperm facial, the injections. I actually talk about them a lot on my social media because I've had them. And I'm so excited to talk to Joanna today all about them. So how are you, Joanna? Hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Great.
Good. So, speak us through, what exactly are polynucleotides?
Yes. So, polynucleotides are basically chains of nucleotides. So, like, they're the building blocks of DNA, and they're the new kid on the block in terms of injectable treatments. They're very much the kind of future of injectable treatments is regenerative injectables. So these are injectables with that little bit of extra power. And so they basically improve the skin at the cellular level. So they are exciting treatments, and they've taken the aesthetic and cosmetic medicine world by storm. As you said, people are calling them salmon facials because they are primarily taken from salmon DNA fragments or fractions.
Yeah, they are quite new to the scene. And I think, yeah, you've just answered my second question, which, do they actually contain salmon sperm? Which I knew they didn't, but I know it's the DNA from salmon sperm, like you said. But yeah, that clears it up for everyone. Because whenever I talk about it, everyone's like, I'm sorry, you put what in your face? So where are they typically?
Yeah, so they're just the building blocks. So they're reduced back so much that you can just essentially understand them as building blocks of DNA.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds nicer. Where are they typically injected? Where, if you were to book in to get them, where would the injections be?
Well, do you know what? We're finding that you can inject them in a lot of places with really good results. So they are backed by a significant library of clinical evidence, which is really important for people like myself. We want to know that treatments work and give results. The results aren't fast, so I always say they're for patients. So it can take a while to get the results, and we can talk about that a little bit more. But typical places that you could use them, I actually love them around the eye because the tissue around the eye is very delicate and 10 times thinner the skin around the eye than on parts of the face. So that's the first area that a lot of people see accelerated aging. So around the eye, they give lovely results. You can inject them all over the face, around the mouth. Again, a very dynamic area because we talk, we eat, that area is always moving. So they can be really nice around the mouth. And also actually on parts of the neck, décolletage, hands. And people are even using them for things like acne scarring, alopecia and hair loss. And for female intimate areas, I think that's an area where regenerative injectables will definitely be making great strides in the future.
Back of the hands is a good one because you just don't notice they start aging until it's too late. Like, I've started to notice mine coming into my 30s. Now I'm like, oh, do I need them there as well? What makes it so different to all the other things? Because there used to be one called Morpheus 8. Wasn't there, that was kind of the tightening one, and now this one's kind of taking over as the new hype injection. So what makes it different, what makes it so much better?
Yeah, I don't think that it's necessarily so much better than things like Morpheus 8, because everything has their place. But what we find with regenerative skin medicine, at least, is that actually combinations of treatments can be very powerful. Often people present to clinic with significant photo damage from exposure to ultraviolet radiation over many, many, many years. And obviously that damages collagen and elastin. We've got people with significant elastosis, lines, wrinkling. So actually having a lot of different treatments that can do different things is really helpful for somebody like me, because certain lines and wrinkles and folds and concerns in the face are caused by different things. So something like Morpheus 8, for example, that's an energy treatment using radio frequency and needling. So that's great for skin tightening. It doesn't do very well around the eyes, whereas polynucleotides is great around the eyes. I think the nice thing about polynucleotides is they're for someone who's looking for a bit of a journey, someone who's happy to go on that regenerative journey. They're not like fillers where you get volume instantly. They take a little while, but they definitely give us more tools with which to treat the skin and make the skin healthier, more vibrant, tighter, tauter, stronger looking, with very low risks as well. That's the other thing that we're always concerned about, is, you know, how risky is the treatment? So we've always got to, as doctors, weigh up risk to benefit ratio.
That was my next question. Are there any risks with it?
Well, anytime you inject anything into the tissue, you're going to be using a needle or a cannula. So you're going to be entering the skin. So there's a risk of bruising. There's a risk of swelling. There's always a risk of infection. So there are these risks always involved with anything injectable, which is why we always say go to somebody who's properly trained, a healthcare professional in a CQC licensed clinic, so that you know what you're getting is clean, sterile, pure, issued from a pharmacy, not counterfeit. We have an issue with that these days. So there are lots of things that you can do as a consumer in terms of your research and your due diligence before you get these treatments to make sure that the risks are minimal. But actually polynucleotides are injected relatively superficially in the skin. So in terms of risk category, in my mind, they are low risk, providing they're done by a well-trained professional and with high quality polynucleotide products.
So two questions I often get whenever I go in for them and post about it is the downtime. So I personally get the little lumps on my face, but it's not too bad. And the price, if you're happy to talk about that, I think that's what people kind of want to know with these treatments. Like, what's the price range of them?
Sure. So downtime, pretty variable, I would say, person to person, and depending on what area you've had injected. Areas like the eyes are a little bit more fragile and sensitive. So if you have it micro-dropletted in with a needle, you might be more inclined to get a bruise. You could ask your practitioner to use a little cannula, which is a very blunt instrument that causes less trauma. So some of it depends on how the polynucleotide was injected. But in my experience, people are having very minimal downtime with these treatments, occasionally a little bit of swelling and bruising, but it's very much a kind of work time procedure. It's not something that I particularly feel I need to tell patients to schedule into their diaries, whereas some treatments definitely need scheduling.
Yeah, it's just things like you can't wear like maybe makeup on the evening and things like that. So if you're going out for dinner, you wouldn't have
that's right
before dinner.
Yeah, good hand hygiene, good hygiene in general, very important after any injectable treatment. So I never let my patients wear makeup for the rest of the day. Unfortunately, I do make them wait till the next day, but that's because I do think we can prevent a lot of unnecessary complications by being really, really strict with our hand hygiene and with our hygiene on the area that's been injected.
Yeah, for sure. And in terms of people budgeting this in to their lifestyle, where would you say the price range is? If you were to just maybe get some little tightening around the eye and on the face, how much is that going to set someone back?
Yeah. So unfortunately, it always depends on many different things, because when I see a patient, I have to assess things like what's the quality of the skin, how many treatments are they going to need. Someone who's got really good skin quality may get away with one or two treatments. I would say most people need two to three treatments, and some people with really loose, lax heavily damaged and elastosed skin may need more treatment. So I think it would be fair to say that the worse quality of skin you have, you may need to have a slightly larger budget. We generally stagger the treatments with a few weeks apart. So for example, if you were come to me to have your eyes treated, I may recommend maybe two treatments initially, and then we'll review and see in maybe 4 weeks after the last treatment how it's going, what improvements you've noticed, because you do notice those kind of improvements. Polynucleotides, depending on geographical area and what clinic you're going to, I guess whether you're in London or somewhere outside of London, they probably vary from 350 to 550. Some are mixed with hyaluronic acid, so you can expect to pay a little bit more for those if they're being injected across your face. So there's lots of variables, unfortunately, and that's why it's always best to have a face-to-face consultation so you can get a very clear idea of what your budget will be so that you can set that aside. And you have to commit to the course. One alone often isn't enough with polynucleotides. With other treatments, it can be. Yeah. But with this, normally it's a course of treatment. So bear that in mind too.
Yeah, I highly rate it. I like it a lot. I've had it, like I said, 3 times, I think, now. My skin used to be horrendous. And I do think once I sorted out the kind of the texture of my skin and the acne scarring I had and then moved on to something like that, it's just made it pop and glow so much more. So I really rate it. Thank you so much for talking us through it. I think it's going to be a really interesting one for a lot of people. So thank you so much for joining us, Joanna.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Have a really good rest of the day.
And you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay. I find that stuff so interesting. I really, really do. I absolutely love anything that's going to make me look 10 years younger, I'm all for. So Gabby, around this time of the show, will always do an exercise of the week. Her favourite exercise, and I have to try and match that with my favourite exercise, but I'm going to actually pick an exercise I absolutely hate, but that's very good for you. If you didn't know what I do a lot of resistance-based training, so a lot of weight training in the gym. And I think the one exercise that is absolutely sadistic, but I love, and my clients hate me for it, is the Bulgarian split squat. It's one that you can do assisted with dumbbells, barbells, or a Smith machine, completely depending where you are, home or gym. You can do it assisted, aka you can hold onto something, and that is going to target the glute max, which is one of our biggest ass muscles, of which we have 3. If you do these unassisted, you're then going to switch the focus over to the glute medius. So it's an exercise that can be tailored to whatever muscle group in the glutes you want to be targeting the most. The reason if we do it unassisted that it's going to hit the glute medius a little bit more is because it's stabilizing us. When we do it unassisted, aka not holding onto anything, we're using a lot more stabilizing muscles to keep us upright and to take us through the movement. And one of those is the glute medius. If we do this holding onto something, or if we do it on a Smith machine or something like that, that's gonna give us a lot more stability. People often think, oh, that's cheating, you're holding onto something, you're not doing it properly. In fact, the added stability to that exercise is going to really help work the glute max. So I love it as an exercise that we can do at home, gym, any level, because again, if you're a beginner, you can use that stability and build up to that. And that's, I use it in a lot of my programs, and a lot of my app clients and one-to-one clients absolutely hate me for it, because I think we all know it's a disgusting exercise. And that leads us up to our first break. After the break, we're going to have Mary McCarthy in the studio with me, which will be nice. She is, as I said, running extraordinaire. She's here to talk to us about all things running and why it is so, so, so popular at the moment. She's also a fitness content creator. So join us after the break, where we'll be chatting to Mary and hearing all about her.
FUBAR Radio presents
What the Health with Gabby Allen. Joining me now is Millie Gooch, author and founder of Sober Girl Sobriety Society. I need to know
What is so bad about dating sober?
I think it's just terrifying when it's something that you're not used to, because when I was drinking and dating, you know, like, you use it to calm your nerves, you use it for confidence, you rely on it. And I think that's the one thing I realised when I stopped drinking, is how much I really relied on alcohol. I was always kind of saying, you know, like, oh, I'm not dependent on it, but for my confidence, I was, really. But I also think there's so many benefits to it. Like, I used to go on so many dates when I was drinking, I'd be like, they are the one. And then I'd meet them, like, a few weeks later sober, and I'd be like, we've got nothing in common. What was going through my mind? I'd be like, oh, it was because I was drunk.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
Harpreet, how are you, my love?
I'm great, thank you. How are you? It looks fun in there.
I want to talk about this because obviously you met your partner on The Apprentice. When did you start to get that feeling, I'm into him and this is more than just a banter or a friendship? Because it's a close environment being on a show like that, isn't it?
I really wish I could sit here and give loads of juicy gossip. Actually, we used to secretly meet in the laundry room on the show, but we didn't. And when I actually last spoke with yourselves, I think it was right after I'd won, we weren't even flirting, never mind dating. First time that I thought I actually fancied him was when I watched him on TV and I watched episode one. Hang on. You know, he's actually really good looking.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
And joining me in the studio, we have Deputy Leader of the Green Party, Zach Polanski. Zach, thank you so much for joining us. How are you keeping, Zach?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. How are you?
So you're hoping for four MPs in the general. You think that's going to happen?
Yeah, that's absolutely the minimum at what we're
I don't want to be Piers Morgan here, but will you take I don't have £1,000, will you take a £100 bet with me that you'll get four MPs?
Well, I do everything in politics to talk about the harms of gambling, so for me to place a bet on there would be pretty, you know, pretty horrendous.
Before we had you on, we discussed with the producers as to whether I should do the bet joke. And I said I would, because I had every faith that you would answer it in the way I expect a politician of any moral
standing. We should also talk about cryptocurrency, which also is very problematic.
Rishi, if you're listening, mate, that's how you answer a betting question.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio. Mary, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for coming in and keeping me company in the studio. So I'm just going to start with some quick fire questions before we chat to you in more detail. So, three words to describe yourself.
Energetic. Oh, God, that's taken me really off guard. Okay, energetic, smiley, and focused.
You are very smiley. okay, in the gym, upper or lower body?
Lower.
Morning or evening workouts?
I'm not a morning person, but always a morning.
Really? I'm really going to try get into that.
Yeah.
I'm an afternoon girl, and I really want to be like, no, up and out.
I started doing it like my last training block. I was like, I'm going to do all my runs in the morning. And it just like made me, like everything was so much easier. Everyone. It was just done in the morning.
Yeah. Okay. You're convincing me more. Go to, I don't want to say cheat meal, but what's your go-to favorite meal if you were out on a weekend or out for dinner?
Oh, my boyfriend loves Nando's.
I love Nando's.
And I've never been a Nando's girl, but now I'm like starting to be like Nando's.
That's my actual favorite.
Nando's or like stone baked pizza.
Yeah.
Like, okay. I'm a sucker for a pizza.
Yeah, we can be friends. Nando and pizza are my two as well. What's your workout anthem? What song always gets you in the mood?
Do you know what? I'm actually so, like, embarrassing, but I, like, love Hannah Montana.
I actually feel like we're going to be friends.
Like, I, like, like, jam to, like, Ordinary Girl in the Gym, or, like, really, like, cringy songs like that. Or, like...
Love that.
Or, like, High School Musical, like... Really like shitty sing-alongs.
I like The Greatest Showman.
Annie. Like, I'm a big Annie fan.
I haven't reached that level yet. But no, I completely get it. Cheesy like musical songs.
Yeah.
Love it. Yeah. And who would be your dream workout partner or running partner?
Jessica Ennis. I think I met her when I did my first ever race when I was like 8. And she was like just before she went into 2012 Olympics, which was just before she like blew up as this like amazing athlete. And I'd love to like sit down and have dinner with her and be like, how was that 5 years?
Yeah, I mean, I can see why.
Yeah.
I can see why she'd be your dream partner. Okay, so we're going to chat more about you. So when did you get into running and fitness and posting all that on social media?
So I've been running since I was 8. My dad's a runner and I used to like competitively swim, and he was like doing a half marathon and was like, do you want to do like the fun run? I mean, I don't remember this conversation. I think he probably made me do the fun run. And then I medaled, and that's when I met Jessica Ennis. And it was literally from then onwards, he was like, maybe you should do the primary school cross country, and did that and won. And it was literally from that day onwards, I've basically been running. So I ran through like primary school, I ran through secondary school, I was at the athletics team at uni, and then moved to London and was like, this is like crazy, like the fitness scene in London is just like incomparable to anything I've ever seen before. Which is when I started posting on like socials, I'd say like more like fitnessy content. But it was very much I started posting for fun. I was like, oh, it'd be fun to like post my runs and like this is how I get ready and this is how I run. But yeah, I've been in the fitness space, I guess, my whole life, which is kind of crazy.
Well, I mean, I guess that makes you enjoy running then, because you've done it since you were so young.
Yeah.
And this is coming from someone who absolutely hates it. I hate it. Yeah. And I want to love it.
Fair.
And I'm hoping this conversation inspires me.
Yeah.
Because I need to be fit. And I'm hitting mid-30s and I'm like, well, I've hit mid-30s and I'm like, I don't do anything good for like my cardiovascular fitness.
Yeah.
And recently I'm like, I need to change my goals. I'm sick of just doing weights. I really want to take up running. But I guess from someone, you did it since such a young age, you've always enjoyed it.
Yeah, I do find like it hard. I find it hard to relate to people sometimes. Like I really try and be like, because it's like I have such a different perspective on everyone else. Like after my first marathon, everyone was like, oh my God, was like, how was it like hitting the wall? And like, was it horrible? And I was like, no, I really enjoyed it.
Oh, and it was God. Like, it was no, like, I've got no hope.
It was like a really like warped perception. But that's why I said to them, I was like, don't take this as like your average girly who started running in lockdown. Like I've been at this game for ages. And like one of my really close friends ran Hackney Half the weekend and she like really struggled like mentally and like felt like really anxious. And I was like, but like people don't understand that like racing is like such a mental game. And I've been in this game for years and raced like countless times, wasn't like if it's your second race, like you're obviously gonna not really know how to like compute those feelings.
So let's not jump straight to wanting to be your level. Okay? Yeah. Got that. And speaking of like races and marathons, I've got here 840,000 people signed up to the London Marathon. So why do you think it's so popular now? Like it like you said, the London scene, especially run clubs, everything like that.
It's just like blown up in the last like 2 to 3
which
years.
Which is great for you.
I mean, it's amazing for me because I'm like, this is my bread and butter. I know exactly what I'm doing.
I'm ready. I've been training for this my whole life.
Yeah, I've literally been, my 8-year-old self was like ready for this. I think lockdown has a massive part to play in it because gyms obviously shut and it was the only thing, like everyone has a pair of, well not everyone has a pair of runners, but if you're a gym girl and like you were like, okay, what do? I can go for a walk, I can go for a run, because that was all we could do. Which I think definitely sparked it. And I think like also like TikTok becoming a thing in lockdown as well. Hand in hand, people
like running and skipping took over TikTok.
Yeah, which is just like a bizarre trend for the 21st century, I think. Like running, but people just posting their runs. And I think just coming out of lockdown, everyone realised that actually like, I think a lot of people realise how much it affects their mental and physical health. I think people will have started doing 5Ks in lockdown and been like, wow, I actually feel really good mentally. Not only like, obviously running is like a great way to like look good and like burn fat. And I think a lot of people won't have realised that until they were kind of like forced into doing it. And also it's just like so accessible because all you need is a pair of trainers.
It's free.
Like not everyone can afford like Third Space memberships.
And in
like
lockdown, especially even getting weights from home.
Yeah,
they just went skyrocketing. Yeah, so I was putting out weight, and people were like, "Well, where do I buy them from?" And they were so expensive.
Do you remember how expensive they got? Because everyone wanted weights, and they were like selling like a dumbbell for like £250. And everyone was like, "Can't do this."
It was madness. I remember, and running's free and accessible to everyone, and it's just, I guess, something you have to be kind of brave enough to just start. I just envision the scene of Phoebe from Friends when I run.
Yeah, that's I think a lot of people say that, but also, you have to start somewhere.
And I feel heavy. I'm like clumpy. I'm a clumpy gal. Right, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. Do you think, well, we kind of answered it, but I guess it, like, I think lockdown fueled it, but I also think like creators like yourself posting about it and talking about it and making people being able to watch it. And like you said, kind of getting ready for runs and what you do to recover from runs and things like that made it a lot more accessible. So do you think the kind of running fitness creator space has had something to do with a lot more people getting into running?
Yeah, I definitely think it's like pushed that lockdown spike a lot more. I think maybe if TikTok hadn't sort of blown up in the way it did, people might have run in lockdown and we came out and it might have gone back to normal and like running. You know, like I was saying the other day, like when I was growing up, like you'd have like your friend's dad who was like the marathon runner and everyone would be like, that's so weird. Like
it was always the dads.
Yeah, you'd be like, there'd be like one dad and you'd be like, oh my God, my dad's running a marathon. Everyone would be like, whoa. And now like everybody's just like running marathons. Like
everyone just signs up for it like, oh, I'm just going to see what happens.
Yeah.
And with no training.
And I'm like, guys, like we need to like reel it back and understand like running a marathon is like crazy.
So, I just could never.
So, yeah, I think being a creator and like showing, like I think it's really hard when you like, I'm, as I said, like understanding how it is to be a novice. Like I forget that like people don't know what to wear. Or like chafing, or like what shoes to wear, or like how there's like tempo shoes, racing shoes, track shoes, like easy shoes, like how long you're meant to wear your shoes for, like all those like things that like fitness creators take for granted. Mm-hmm. People are like so invested in like seeing what you're doing. So I'm like, oh, I've worn this pair of shoes now for 500K. I'm getting a new pair, and people are like, what? And I think like that information being so accessible on just like to flip through on our phones is like really just like keeping everybody like running.
I 100% agree as a creator online. It's we don't realize the things we do now every day were once the things we wanted to maybe know about right at the start, and we forget to talk about, and we're like, no one wants to hear this, it's so basic, why would anyone want to see that? And then we remember, because someone's literally starting their journey from day one.
Yeah.
And it's these simple little broken down things that we just now do out of habit.
Yeah.
We don't think about them. And I'm like, God, do people really want to see that?
I think that all the time. I'm like, surely I don't want to post that because everyone's going to be like, Mary, everyone knows that.
And then, you're like not, you're getting new eyes every day. And there are these some people who've never ran or never stepped foot in the gym, so you kind of really have to take it back to basics and repost that stuff all the time, and I'm like, surely people are sick of me by now.
And I think
it's tough.
It's that sharing of knowledge that I think people are like so interested in, because like we are coming from a space of being experts in our fields, and like you forget, like I forget that, like
that you were once not an expert in your field.
And I'm like talking to my friends who do like insane like HYROX and like CrossFit, and I'm like, what's the difference? Like I'm like, I don't get
it. But I need someone to break down like, what is HYROX? All I see is these mad crazy fit people at these competitions, and I'm like, HYROX,
literally like
CrossFit to me.
But if someone did a video like breaking down what it was, I'm sure everyone would be like, wow. And it's the same thing I guess for like gym or like running. People just want to know the basics.
And do you think younger people are kind of leaning more into fitness because it's more accessible, maybe to previous generations? Fitness was a big thing, but especially I think in my field, which is weights, women lifting weights in the gym, it is a lot more popular now than it was back in the day. And do you think running is a lot more popular now for the younger generation?
Oh my God, yeah. I said after London, I'd love to see the stats from like 5 years, not even 10 years ago, like 5 years ago to now, because I reckon the shift in like the average age and like women to men has like completely flipped on its head. Like the amount of like, even just like me like watching Brighton Marathon, and the amount of like girls like in their like vests and their like scrunchies in their hair, and like it's all this like whole like culture of like being a runner as like a 20 something female definitely just was. Even when I was running when I was like 16, there wasn't like,
you were just running.
Yeah, like I was very much like, it was like athletics, like you were either like competing in the on track, or like it wasn't really like a community that you'd go into, like whereas in now you can be like part of these run clubs around London, and it's just like you just go for runs on the weekend, and that's like a whole community. Whereas in like, I grew up in a sport where like you either like competing or you're retired kind of thing, and now it's like this like amazing like community of like people like around the world.
It's made running fun.
Yeah,
I guess.
And yeah. I think it will carry on. I can't see it like slowing down.
Well, if people like me are even debating it, something's happening.
Yeah.
What's been your proudest achievement in your running career?
I've had a lot of things I've like come through, I guess I'm proud of. Like my first marathon, surprisingly, was only literally last December.
Oh, really?
So like literally like half a year ago.
How come it took you that long?
I think everyone was like so shocked when I was training for it, and they were like, oh, what are you going for? And I was like, well, it's my first marathon, so like da-da-da. And they were like, what?
Had you run before distance-wise? You've never done that distance.
Never even done the distance.
Out.
I think, as I said, because I was like in like competitive sport, it was very much like every age category I was in, it was like you trained for a distance or like we trained for cross country. So it wasn't like we were just like, because it's like such a bread and butter now, you see on social media, like everyone's doing a half marathon or everyone's doing a marathon like in their spare time. It just like wasn't like that when we were growing up. I think it would be different even if you were in that space now as a 16-year-old. But I was always like training for a 1500 or like training for a 6K cross country race. Like we didn't do like 20K, like we didn't do like 25K on a Saturday. Like just wasn't a thing. And then I remember like getting on into the ballot of Valencia and being like, oh, maybe I should do it. And like, but still even being like, oh, I don't know if I want to do it. And people being like, no, do it, be fun. So my first, I think one of my proudest achievements is my first marathon, because I went into it like pretty clueless as a marathon runner. And like just really surprised myself.
Is it as good as what people say in terms of the atmosphere?
It was insane. Yeah. I think every marathon's different. Obviously, like the crowds and stuff are so different, but Valencia, like crowds were like insane. Like I enjoyed like every single kilometre of it. I had a massive group of friends, which was like so fun. But yeah, completing my first marathon, which I didn't quite do the sub 3, which I was going for.
That's meant. You're meant. That.
I was going for in London and then got injured, which is annoying. But like my redemption marathon, I'm hoping will be this year.
Is that a goal?
Yeah.
That was going to be my next question. Like, do you have any goals coming up?
Yeah.
It would be a sub 3.
Yeah.
Wow.
I have Cologne Marathon like towards the end of this year. That's going to be the goal for that. Get rid of my injury and train.
So that will be your second?
So I did London.
This year?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that'll be, which is mad because I've done 3 marathons within the space of a year.
You're mad. I think I've established on this conversation. We don't need to clarify that. It's not mad. It's like, I could never.
Yeah.
I look up to it.
It is crazy. But I even like if you'd asked me like 2 years ago, like I'd been like, I don't know if I want to train for a marathon. Like, that's a big thing. And then literally a couple of months ago, I did my first ever ultra marathon, which was probably like also probably like one of my proudest achievements, because that was just like insane on my body, but just like on my mind. I didn't realize I could like push that hard. My brain could push that hard.
It's a big mental game.
Yeah, massively.
What do you think is, what would you give your tips to people who do struggle with the mental part of it? Like, because it's so much to do with your brain telling you keep going.
Yeah, it is. I'd say for people who are like struggling mentally to like carry on, just like take it slow. Like I know a lot of people like start running, like yourself, like you're like, I don't know how to start. Like people see everyone on the internet and see like these professional athletes doing marathons and they're like, oh yeah, I did my first 10K, I'm gonna sign up to a half. And I'm like, do you understand how much like commitment that is of your life to train for a half marathon? I think, like, if I'd give any advice to anyone on the internet, it should be, like, slow down and stay in your own lane. Like, don't compare yourself to everyone on TikTok and everyone.
Don't rush to hit these big numbers.
Yeah, like, aim to run a 5K and then you'll, like, really enjoy it. And then once you've run a 5K and you're, like, comfortable, then, like, yeah, maybe do a 10K. But, like, you will enjoy it so much more if you just stick, like, do it, build up slowly.
I remember back in the day, I worked in an office. I must have been 24. And someone bet me I couldn't run a 10K. And I was like, 10K? Yeah, I could.
Yeah.
And they were like, no, you couldn't. You couldn't just get up. You're not a runner. You couldn't just get up. And I was like, watch me. And I'm stubborn.
Yeah.
Right? I did it. And I ran round Battersea Park. I think it was maybe 4 or 5 times with my friends.
Yeah, it would have been.
Until I did it.
Yeah.
And I managed. I managed. And now, 10 years later, I don't know whether that was like lucky young genetics.
Yeah.
I think I did 5 minutes on level 10 on Stairmaster the other day.
Yeah.
Hyperventilating. Like it's, and now I look back at that 10 years and was like, I wish I'd kept up with something with all my kind of cardiovascular fitness.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you've done it good.
Well, if you prove yourself, you could do a 10K then. You definitely got in. You should start your like.
I mean, I think I can do it, and then I start not being able to breathe. So, yeah. So you know that just might hold me back.
Instead of being like, I'm gonna do a 10K, just be like, just tomorrow, just go and run a 1K run. Just do 1K.
I'll do 1K. I'm gonna start. So any other goals in the next 1 minute left? Any other quickfire goals you want to achieve?
Sub 3 hour marathon's a big one. Yeah. Like that'll be like a properly like big achievement for me. And an Ironman.
Oh god. Is this a hybrid athlete? Is that what they call it?
Yeah. So because I used to swim when I was little, I have the background of swimming, so I'm like half Ironman. Potentially this year or early next year.
You're going to smash it. I mean,
it's a big goal.
You're going to smash it. I have no absolute, like, no doubt. Yeah. It seems like you've kind of achieved everything you set your mind to. So well done. And thank you so much for coming in. It's been so good to chat.
Yeah.
You've motivated me. I've got a lot, many others. And we're going to take another quick break. But coming up after this, Johan Harriet, journalist and author of The Magic Pill. We're going to be chatting all things Ozempic.
FUBAR Radio presents
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's fan club.
We're joined in the studio now by one of my favourite comedians, Rhys James. I always say in taxis and stuff like that, I always say I'm a writer.
Yeah, me too. Have I told you this story before?
No.
The time I got in a taxi, and I always used to do that writer because you don't want to have the conversation with the taxi driver about being a comedian.
But the follow-up question is just that you can't get out of, which is, what do you write?
Yeah,
I write sitcoms.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. So I was in this taxi, he goes, what sort of stuff do you write? And I went, comedy. I thought, yeah, and then he went, oh, what type of comedy do you write? And I said, satire. And then the taxi driver said, you know what they say? Satire is the lowest form of wit.
Access all areas. We have got Lily in the house.
So excited to be here. The problem is, when you start getting a few followers on Instagram, people will look at you.
Mm.
People want to get to know you. They will, and girls and guys, will not give a fuck. And if you are on a night out and you're a guy and some, you know, hot girl comes up to you, like, it happens. And guys are going to be like, oh, my God. And they suddenly get all this attention. And my boyfriend has joined me on Made in Chelsea. And I remember when the producers called me to be like, look, we want Billy on the show. I was like, is this a good idea? Like, not that he'd cheat, but
it's
like,
a risky move, though.
It is. It's like, because this could, like, this person I love and I, like, want to be with him forever. But if this could fuck up everything. Politics
Uncensored. I am delighted to be joined by Patsy Stevenson this week. You went to the vigil and you had you were arrested, and the picture of your arrest was in every newspaper and I think on the feed of every person in this country's social media. Do you mind talking to us a little bit about why you went and what you think that has sparked now, the conversation around policing and how important that is?
The reason that my picture went viral is much to do with the fact that I'm white and because of the way I look. And a lot of other people who are arrested unlawfully, they don't get platforms, they don't get book deals, you know what I mean?
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
Johan, hello. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Gabby. Great to be with you.
So I'm Harriet. I'm covering for Gabby today.
Great.
I'm just covering in, but it's definitely a chat. She's going to be gutted she missed. I am so, so excited to talk about this. You are going to chat today about the word that's on everyone's lips when it comes to weight loss, which is Ozempic. I know I'm super interested in finding out kind of everything, the good, the bad, the ugly about it. It has been kind of, there's been some recent studies that suggest the jab could risk heart attacks. You yourself, alongside all the other kind of weight loss benefits that is giving to some people, but you yourself took the drug. And you wrote about it in your new book, Magic Pill. So let's start from the top. What is Ozempic? Let's start with that for people that might not know.
From the moment I learned about these drugs, I was both excited and very wary. So we have a new kind of weight loss drug that works in a completely new way that I can explain to you that causes an extraordinary amount of weight loss. The average person who takes Ozempic or Wegovy loses 15% of their body weight within a year. I lost 3 stone in a year. The average person who takes Mounjaro, which is the next in this group of drugs, loses 21% of their body weight. And the next of these drugs that's going to be available next year, Triple G probably, you lose 24% of your body weight on average. So it's a staggering new form of weight loss drug that 47% of Americans know what to take because it has such an incredible effect. So I spent a year researching this drug all over the world, from Iceland to Minneapolis to Japan, taking it myself, figuring out what it does to you, the positives, the negatives, by interviewing the leading scientists, the biggest defenders of the drugs, the biggest critics of the drugs. And I learned a huge amount about the subtitle of my book is called Magic Pill, but the subtitle is The Extraordinary Benefits and Disturbing Risks of the New Weight Loss Drugs. And I think everyone needs to know about both halves of that.
Mm-hmm, for sure. So you first taking it, what influenced you to first take it, but it was just, you were curious about what are the side effects and what are the
It was much more than that. I mean, it was, I'm older now than my grandfather ever got to be because he died of a heart attack when he was 44. Loads of the men in my family get heart disease. My dad's had terrible heart problems. My uncle died of heart problems. If something you said in your intro, it wasn't quite right. In fact, these drugs massively reduce the risk of heart attack and stroke. If you take them and you started with a BMI higher than 27, your chance of having a heart attack or stroke goes down by 20%. So the driver for me, I mean, it's complicated, isn't it? It's also tied up with wanting to look kind of conventionally more hot. But for me, I was, you know, I knew that being obese, sadly, massively increases the risk of all sorts of problems, over 200 known diseases and complications, pretty much all the stuff we feared, dementia, heart disease, diabetes, stroke, just across the board, it's unfortunately very bad for you. So I knew, wow, if there's a drug that really does massively reduce obesity, that's going to have all sorts of positive effects. But I also learned there are 12 significant risks associated with these drugs that we all need to think about. And what we need to do, if you're listening to this and you're overweight and obese, really you have to compare two sets of risks. There's the risk of being obese, and then there's the risks associated with the drugs. And I think you need to go, I hope my book Magic Pill is really a guide so you can go through this at a very personal level. And be like, okay, which of these risks apply to me? What do I want to do here? Also helps you to understand how it feels to take the drugs, what it's like to take them, how it affects you physically, how it affects you psychologically. There's a lot here I think people need to know.
So what did you think were the initial effects? What did you see as the initial effects when you first started taking
them? It's the weirdest thing, Harriet. I never forget. The second day I was taking them, I was lying in bed and I woke up and I thought, oh, I feel something a bit strange. What is it? And I couldn't quite place what I was feeling. I couldn't figure it out. And it took me a couple of minutes to realize I had woken up and I wasn't hungry. I used to wake up every day with this like raging hunger. And I went to this cafe just up the road from where I live that morning. And I ordered what I used to order every morning, I'm slightly embarrassed to say, which is a massive chicken bap with loads of chicken and mayo in it. And I had like 3 mouthfuls of it and I just was full. Right. So what these drugs do is they massively boost your sense of fullness. Right. If you ate something now, Harriet, it doesn't matter what it is, your pancreas would produce a hormone called GLP-1. And basically GLP-1 is part of your body's natural systems going, hey, Harriet, you've had enough. Stop eating. Right. You know, it's like the brakes, basically. But natural GLP-1 only sits around in your system for a couple of minutes. Then it's washed away. You can eat again if you want to. What these drugs do is they inject you with an artificial copy of GLP-1. That instead of sticking around for a few minutes, sticks around for a whole week. That's why you feel very full very fast. It's why I went from eating, you know, 3,200 calories a day to about 1,800 calories a day. So a massive decline. And I don't feel hungry, right?
So you can still eat, or you do feel hungry a little bit, or just not at all. You're kind of just eating for because you have to. Because there's people who like,
much
enjoy
less hungry.
Food.
Less hungry than you were before. Some people, if they take too high a dose, actually it kind of eliminates their hunger, and that's quite dangerous. It's one of the risks.
Yeah.
But if you get your dose right, you're hungry enough that, you know, look, I'm now, you know, 11 and a half stone. That's the weight a man my age should be. I'm 45, right? So I'm eating at the right level. before I was eating way, way too much. Now, if I was taking a higher dose, I would probably be eating too little. So you've got to get the dose right.
Did you think it changed cravings for certain foods? Like a lot of people say, oh, I get a sweet tooth. Do you think it lowered those? Or do you think you still look forward to food? You're just not as hungry. Did it change anything else in terms of like cravings?
So most people who take these drugs seem to say it reduces their pleasure in food. And that is one of the significant drawbacks associated with these drugs. Actually, weirdly for me, it had the opposite effect, but I think I'm a bit unusual. So the way I used to eat was I would stuff myself, right? I would eat to comfort myself, to calm myself down. It's funny, I had a real epiphany about this in, I was in a branch of KFC in Las Vegas, and I'd had a rough day. I was investigating the murder of someone that I knew and loved. So it was, you know, kind of hard for a different book. And I went into this brunch KFC that I've been into 1,000 times. And because I was feeling bad, I ordered what I would have ordered, you know, a year before when I wasn't on Ozempic. I ordered a bucket of fried chicken and I had one of the chicken drumsticks. And I suddenly looked at the bucket and I thought, oh shit, I can't eat this, right? You can't massively overeat when you're on Ozempic. You would be sick, right? And I suddenly realized, oh, you're just going to have to feel bad. And it was a moment when it became clear to me what food did for me, right? We all have different relationships with food. I go through in my book, Magic Pill, 5 different kind of psychological drivers why we eat. For a lot of people, those come to the surface when you're taking these drugs. So that was difficult. Actually, I found better ways to deal with being distressed than Colonel Sanders. But actually also because I had to eat more slowly, actually, for me, it increased my pleasure in food.
Yeah.
I don't want to overstate it, but like before, I was stuffing myself to have that feeling of being stuffed to calm myself down. Now I actually taste, because I have to eat more slowly, I actually taste my food more and I enjoy it more.
I mean, that's good, because I do know like binge eating is it doesn't necessarily, you don't necessarily have to be overweight to struggle with, sure, binge eating. And I know it's something, well, from my personal experience, from what my clients tell me, it's not an enjoyable feeling afterwards. They feel that guilt afterwards. And yeah, it might not be making them clinically obese, but there's that kind of negative connotation they have with binge eating. So I guess kind of taking your time and more enjoying your food, regardless of the Ozempic, is something we do advise my clients anyway, because it does just increase that enjoyment of eating the meal and sitting down and taking your time and enjoying it. So yeah, that leads us on to kind of the next question. Did taking it at all change your relationship with food now? Kind of based on what you just said, do you find you do take your time or enjoy food more, even now you're not taking it?
Definitely. Well, I'm still taking it.
So
the reason I decided to continue taking it is, so as I say, in the book, I go through the risks of obesity versus the risks of, you know, the 12 big risks associated with these drugs, which range quite widely. And for me, I judge that given the heart disease risk in my family, that the benefits of these drugs outweighed the risks. But lots of other people will read my book, Magic Pill, go down the list of risks and benefits and go, do you know what, for me, actually, these risks outweigh the benefits. So it varies. One thing we've got to distinguish as well, and I think it's really interesting you say about binge eaters who are not obese, I also think you've got to distinguish two very different groups of people when we're talking about Ozempic. There are overweight and obese people who take these drugs to get down to a healthy weight. There's still some risks associated with that, but I think that's very defensible, right? I interviewed a guy called Jeff Parker in San Francisco, who lives in San Francisco. He was very severely overweight. He was in a lot of pain. He had all sorts of liver and kidney problems. He started taking Mounjaro, one of the new weight loss drugs, lost a huge amount of weight. Now he walks his dog over the Golden Gate Bridge every day. He said to me, I feel like I'm going to enjoy my retirement. There's a lot of people like Jeff. It's really defensible. And for him, that drug is probably saving his life, as it might be for me. There's another category of people who are not overweight, who are a normal weight or indeed skinny, who are taking those drugs to be super thin, right? Now, I don't judge anyone in that position. Those are overwhelmingly women. We make women feel like shit about their bodies no matter what they do. You don't need me as a man to mansplain that to you, Harriet. I know that. I don't judge them at all, but I would urge those women to not do that, because there are health risks associated with being too thin. They're taking all the risks of the drugs and they're making themselves super thin, which causes other problems that I can talk about, for no benefit apart from an aesthetic one. So I think you've got to separate out these two groups. I'm very excited about what this can do for people who are overweight and obese, although I am still worried about risks even for people like us. And I'm very worried about what's happening with people who are taking it who are not overweight. My biggest worry in the of all the 12 risks that I write about in my book, Magic Pill, the one I'm most worried about is what is happening with people with eating disorders who are getting these drugs. Anyone who knows anyone with an eating disorder knows there's a conflict going on inside them. There's the psychological part of them that wants to starve themselves for all sorts of complicated reasons. And then there's the biological, physical part of them that wants to live and wants to eat, right? And what these drugs can do is just, if you take a high dose, they just amputate your appetite, right? So I'm very worried. People like Dr. Kimberly Dennis, who's one of the leading eating disorders experts in the US, you know, said these drugs are rocket fuel for eating disorders. I'm really worried. We've got to right now regulate that, because at the moment, anyone listening can basically go online and get these drugs on Zoom, right? You're meant to see a doctor, but they see you on Zoom.
This is what I was going to ask. Where do you get it? Isn't there like regulation of a doctor should see you and prescribe it to you? Or can you literally just go and buy a Ozempic?
Exactly. I can see you, Harriet. You are not eligible for these drugs, right? You should not be given them. I guarantee you, within an hour, you could have it, right? So doctors are seeing people on Zoom. They're meant to check your BMI on Zoom. Good luck with that. We need to change the rules. These drugs should only be given to people who've had inpatient appointments with a doctor in person, who see that person, and those doctors should be trained in detecting eating disorders. That will save a lot of people's lives if we do that.
Yeah. And you think the biggest risks, like you, well, one of the biggest risks is people, it's like celebrities are taking it. And we were talking about this before, and I think you can start, I'm not going to name names, I think you can start to tell who suddenly lost a lot of body fat very quickly. And then it makes women suddenly aspire to look like that. And you said, yeah, the risks for those people who are doing it purely from aesthetics and people who may already struggle with eating disorders, for those it's massively dangerous. But you think the benefits for people who need it, they might be obese, hold a lot of body fat, and are doing it for health benefits, like the guy you spoke to, you think that's, you would recommend that for those people?
For some of those people, I mean, there are other risks, right? Yeah. Some doctors, for example, think it increases your risk of thyroid cancer, although this is disputed. But then other doctors said to me, even if that's true, that the drug increases the risk of thyroid cancer, we know that obesity increases the risk of a huge array of cancers. When you carry excess weight in your body, as Cancer Research UK explains, it doesn't just sit there, right? It's not inactive, it's active. It sends signals through your body. One of the signals it sends is for your cells to divide more rapidly, which can cause cancer. It's why actually cancer is, obesity is one of the biggest causes of cancer in Britain. So at every stage, you've got to be weighing these competing risks, right? So if, for example, you're very overweight or even slightly overweight and you're thinking of taking these drugs, but you have thyroid cancer in your family, then I would say, actually, I would recommend not taking it. Of course, people should consult their doctors. I'm not a doctor, but based on the people I interviewed. But, you know, I keep thinking about this because one of the things people are worried about, and I'm worried about, is we don't know the long-term risks associated with these drugs. Diabetics have been taking them for 18 years. For obesity, they've been used for like 2 years now. But one of the leading obesity specialists in the US, Dr. Shauna Levy, said to me, look, we don't know the long-term risks of these drugs. We do know the long-term risks of obesity, and they are really serious. So I think for someone like me, I've been obese pretty much all my adult life with a few short exceptions. I had tried the diet and exercise route. I talk in the book about why everyone should try that first, of course, but why that actually fails for 90% of people. The environment we're living in makes it very hard to keep weight off. And as you become overweight or obese, there are changes that happen in your brain that make it harder to go back. It's not impossible, but harder. That's what, you know, I felt like such a failure that I did all the things you're meant to do. And I usually ended up fatter than I was at the start. In fact, I was a completely typical product of our environment and our time. So if you're listening and you're in that position, don't feel ashamed. There's nothing wrong with you. There's something wrong with the way we're living, but we can fix that. And I talk about how we can do that in the book. But
we do have to wrap it up. I'm so sorry.
Sure.
We've gone over because it's so interesting. It's so interesting to hear you talk. Really quick, one finishing comment. I would say it would be go and read the book and kind of make your own assumptions and assess your own lifestyle and whether it is something you could take. But what really quick final comment on this, what would
the book is called Magic Pill. The book is called Magic Pill. These drugs are blowing up how we think about obesity. They are going to change the world around us for better and for worse. We really need to take a beat to think about their benefits and their risks for ourselves and for all the people around us.
Amazing. Honestly, such an interesting, I could sit here all day.
Oh, cheers, Harriet.
Thank you so much for joining us, and have a good rest of your
pleasure.
Day. Bye. I love that chat. I could literally sit here and talk to him all day, but we are going to end on some listener questions. You can get involved if you want and DM at What the Health Show on Instagram anytime if you do have a question. So I'm just going to run through these and quick fire some answers to you. Lily asks, I'm overweight. She wants to start working out. However, the last time I stepped in the gym, she was laughed at by a group of girls, which really knocked her confidence. Any advice to deal with this? And firstly, I'm very sorry. Secondly, send them my way. I'll have words. Thirdly, the thing I always say is anyone mocking you or judging you or criticizing you is never the ones doing better than you. They're always the one that inside. Imagine being that person to laugh or mock or criticize and spend your life making fun of someone else. Something's not right with those people. Everyone starts somewhere. Everyone starts as a beginner, whether that be in work, office life, getting a new job. You always walk into a new environment whenever you start something like that. See the gym as kind of a new workplace you're showing up to each day. And I promise you, the more you learn, this is why education is so key. This is the reason I do what I do as a job. My job is to educate women. It's not just to post random workouts. It's not just to post pictures of myself on Instagram. I have a fitness app that actually educates women with the basics and helps them feel confident. I would say first and foremost, go into the gym. And if you do feel a little intimidated, first of all, grab a couple of dumbbells and take yourself to an area of the gym where you feel comfortable until you build that confidence up. It's not a race. And try to ignore the kind of people that knock you down, because they're the ones with serious issues, not you. Second question, what is some common fitness advice you disagree with? I can't stand when everyone says go hard or go home. It is literally the most ridiculous saying. I know that's not advice, but it's that kind of advice. Or look, if you don't give it your all, you may as well go home. Like, no, there are days you will rock up to the gym and give it 50%. And there's a saying that goes, if all you've got is 50%, then you gave it 100%. Every day, every workout is not always going to be a smash it out of the park workout. That if this is something that's your lifestyle and you're going to do it for the rest of your life, like showing up for work, like I said, like you're showing up for appointment, there are going to be days you don't enjoy it. Some days you like your job, some days it stresses you out and you're there because you have to be, right? I see fitness like that. There are some days I don't want to be there. I might not be able to give it my all. I might feel shit. I might be going through stress in my life. And it doesn't necessarily, I don't sit there and think, oh, I'm not going to give it my all today, so I'm going to sit at home. I think I'm going to show up and I'm going to do what I can. And those are the habits, and that is the attitude that's going to keep you consistent in your fitness journey, rather than thinking you always have to be better, beat yourself, like beat the number. I can't stand that attitude. And really quickly, last question, Lana, I want to start eating healthy, awful cook, join the club. And I love takeaways, tips for eating better. These are really boring, but be a creature of habit. So what I say to my clients, find some meals, write them down that are going to work, that you enjoy. Pick foods you enjoy. Start with picking a protein, add a carb, add some veg, and add some fats, right? Build meals like that. Always build them around a source of protein. So say you fancy chicken, what carb do you want? Pasta, what veg do I want? I'm going to add some peppers, onions, and tomatoes. What fats do I want? I'm going to add some mozzarella cheese, maybe some pesto for flavor, right? You've built that meal based on those kind of ingredients that you enjoy and fancy, and you become a creature of habit. And that can be a meal you make yourself 4 or 5 times a week. And yes, it's boring. And yes, it might get annoying eating the same things on repeat. But the easier you make something for yourself, the easier it is to prepare, to cook, like meal prep and things like that, the easier it is for you to grab something from your fridge, you're going to remain consistent with it. The more difficult we make for ourselves. So following recipes on Instagram, I love these creators who put out recipes out there. But for me, I'm never going to make that. I don't have the time and I can't be bothered. So I make things easier for myself by keeping it simple and prepping easy meals that I know I can eat often. So being a creature of habit. We have to round it up there. So thank you to every guest who's been on the show today. Thank you for putting up with me, covering in for Gabby. Download the app to listen each week and follow on Instagram, as I mentioned earlier, at What The Health Show, and you'll be able to listen back on all podcasting platforms. So thank you so much. I think normal service resumes next week at 11 a.m. with Gabby. Bye.